We're spending the hour on a new biography about the rise and fall of Senator Joe McCarthy. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. New documents are public. Boxes of unscripted writings and correspondence, military records, wartime medical charts, financial files. We will gain a fuller portrait of the senator who was born in Grand Chute, who in 1954 accused the army of being soft on communism. McCarthy's Senate subcommittee held televised hearings for 36 days.
If we, unless we, make sure that there is no infiltration of our government, then just as certain as you sit there, in the period of our lives, you will see a red world.
Do you remember these hearings? What do you want to know about McCarthy's life and tactics? We're at 800-642-1234. Larry Tye is the author of books about Bobby Kennedy, Leroy Satchel Page, Superman, among others. His new book is called Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. Larry, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Great to be back with you.
Well, let's start in Wisconsin, taking us back to an era when, you know, I wasn't alive. How can you explain McCarthy's trajectory from being born in Grand Chute? Take us from there to Capitol Hill and when he became Joe McCarthy, the senator of Wisconsin.
So it's appropriate that we're talking about this the week after July 4th, because his career took off like fireworks. He started out running for office not far from his native Grand Chute, running for district attorney. And what was interesting about that race, which he lost overwhelmingly, was that he ran as a Democrat and as a flaming New Deal FDR supporter. And he ran that way. I think he believed it. And when he lost, he took away a lesson, which was Democrats wouldn't have much of a shot at getting the offices that he wanted in that part of Wisconsin. So the next time he ran, it was as a nonpartisan for an office of circuit judge. He ran, he took on a very popular incumbent. He went both high and low, by which I mean he ran a partly substantive campaign, but when it was necessary, he embellished and lied and smeared. And the judge that he beat later on, that judge's son called that judge the first victim of McCarthyism. Joe served for a while as circuit judge, and then with extraordinary chutzpah, he ran at a young age with none of the experience that somebody normally has to run for a U.S. senator. He ran once and lost. He came back and took those lessons into a race against one of the titans of Wisconsin politics back then, Robert La Follette, whose father had been a senator, and he himself had been a senator for three terms. McCarthy again went high and low. He argued substance when he thought that would work. He embellished or lied when he thought that would work. He beat La Follette, beat the Democrat, and went to Washington in early 1947 as one of the youngest, one of the most brash, and soon to become the most famous person in the entire U.S. Senate.
So these tactics for winning an election were a harbinger of how he acted as a senator?
Absolutely. Everything that he showed, the good and the bad in the early years, are things that he would reflect again in all the things that made him famous and that have us 70 years after the fact still talking about Joe McCarthy.
And he flipped parties several times, going back and forth between Republican and Democrat. Was he floundering on his own ideological issues, or was this purely to win?
Well, I think that the flips were part of the streak of opportunism in him. He, I think, believed in the things that he was saying about FDR at the time, but he equally had no problem not just flipping from Democrat to Republican, but flipping from an ultra-liberal Democrat to the standard bearer for a part of the Republican Party in Wisconsin that back then and maybe still were called stalwart Republicans, and they were the most conservative part of the party. And Joe McCarthy became their standard bearer because that became the easiest way to win the office that he wanted.
We're talking with Larry Tighe, author of the new book. It's called Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Have you read other biographies about Joe McCarthy, and what are they like? What questions do you have about the life and career of the senator? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. You got access to documents that have never been seen before for decades, like 60 years. What were you able to get your hands on? Where did these documents come from?
So the documents were there all those 60 years, gathering dust in the archives, the great archival collection at Marquette University. And they were put there by Joe McCarthy's widow shortly after he died and shortly before she died. They were everything from his correspondence to his wartime diaries to things that gave us a look at him as a person and as a public figure that we had never seen before. And I would like to tell you, Kate, that it was because I was charming and they just couldn't say no to me. But I think more likely is the fact that I was lucky and was enough of a pain in the neck that the easiest way to deal with me was finally to say yes. I also had a friend who was a very influential person in helping me get access, and she's a well-known TV news personality, Greta Van Susteren, whose father was Joe McCarthy's closest friend and who helped me convince the family to open those documents. And I want to say, by the way, that the documents, I was lucky in getting a look at the documents, but the day that I stopped looking, they went back under lock and key. The provision in opening them up was that they would be opened exclusively. So I tried my best to do the work on behalf of all the biographers who would have and should have probably gotten a look at them long before. And I want to, if I could, just tell you two quick stories on things I found that made him look better and things that made him look worse.
Please do.
So the better is, when McCarthy first ran for Senate, he actually ran in a way that he wasn't supposed to be running, which was when he was a Marine on his island in the South Pacific. And there was a very explicit provision that all Marines knew about, that you don't run for office when you're serving in the military. Joe McCarthy ignored that rule like he did most rules in his life. He had big banners on his tents and on his truck saying McCarthy for Senate. But one of the things about him, one of the things that reporters reported on him repeatedly and became part of the historic record on Joe McCarthy, was that he was fudging when he took on the moniker Tail Gunner Joe. And to this day, many people, that's the way they know him, not Senator Joe McCarthy, but Tail Gunner Joe. He took it on because he said he was a hero as a tail gunner, taking on the Japanese during World War II. The reporters who were covering him said that, like many things with him, is an embellishment, if not a lie, that he was, in fact, a land-based intelligence officer whose duty didn't involve going up in the air or putting himself at risk. What we know now, having seen his documents in these closed archives at Marquette, is that he kept a real-time diary during his time in the military that proved that, in fact, at great risk to himself, while his assignment was being grounded on the as an intelligence officer, he was up flying, he was getting shot at, and we have records from all of his squad mates there saying that they could prove that he was there.
We're exploring Life and Times of Senator Joe McCarthy. New biography incorporates newly released documents. It's Larry Tighe, the author. It's called Demagogue. You can join in with your questions about McCarthy, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Larry Tighe on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about a new biography about the life and political career of Senator Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have biographer Larry Tighe, who calls McCarthy the bully from Wisconsin, who became powerful enough to intimidate President Dwight Eisenhower, to send people to prison unjustly, to drive others to die by suicide. Ty reviewed 9,000 pages of transcripts from McCarthy's closed-door congressional hearings. What do you want to know about the life and times of Joe McCarthy? What stories did you hear that you want to clarify? How do you see McCarthyism? Join in 800-642-1234. Larry Ty's new book is called Demagogue, and he stays with us. Let's take a call now. Randy is with us from Madison. Hi, Randy.
Hello. Good morning. Thanks for being here, Mr. Ty. I've studied quite a bit about the McCarthy era, and I was in the Marines. And you're the first person I've ever heard say that that McCarthy was showing some heroism in when he went on his joyrides. It's well established he went up in the air many, many times, and the line was that no coconut was safe when he was riding, because he was always shooting up the jungle, having fun with the machine gun. But I've never heard anybody say that he actually saw combat, had any kills. And I do know that in his post-war campaign, he claimed once that he had 10 pounds of shrapnel in one leg.
Well, Randy, I want to jump in here. I want to jump in here and let Larry respond more to his military career.
Sure. So, Randy, thank you for your question and thank you for your service. And you're right that people did say that was part of the disparagement of his wartime service, was that he was shooting up more coconuts than enemies. And I don't know whether he ever got any kills. What I do know is that we've never seen before his actual wartime diaries. And those confirm what his squad mates were saying, that in addition to his wanting to go up and be a showman, that he actually earned the dozen medals that he got, and that many people had assumed he got for political reasons. And I think that that's much of what my book does is say that this guy was in fact a more sinister character than we knew. But there are other ways we've got to be fair to him and give a more nuanced portrait. And I stand behind the records that I read saying that he was in fact doing things that he didn't have to do, that put his life at risk, and his squad mates say that actually did something good in going up and serving on these missions that mattered.
Larry, you use the word bully dozens of times in your book, and I'm wondering, what did McCarthy do with his tactics for smearing people? How did he intimidate?
So he intimidated lots of ways. One was by taking them in behind closed doors. And when the doors were shut, he ceased even pretending to care about the rights of the accused, who he summarily dismissed by declaring them guilty and by calling them Fifth Amendment communists. He held one-man hearings, which was a violation of longstanding Senate tradition. When he couldn't be there to oversee the hearing, he put sophomoric staffers like Roy Cohn in charge to do the badgering of witnesses on his behalf. And what we also saw in a pattern that I found both interesting and disturbing was that during the morning sessions of those hearings, and I read thousands of pages of transcripts about them, McCarthy looked kind of reasonable. In the afternoon, after he had had his favorite lunch of hamburger, raw onion, and whiskey, he started getting less patient. He was much quicker to jump down the throat of witnesses and accuse them, based on things that they might have done 20 years before when they were in college, of somehow being a threat to the government job that they held and to the country.
You looked at his medical records. What did they say about alcoholism?
So they were depressing. I was out for a walk early one morning from my home on Cape Cod, and there was an enormous brown box that I saw at the head of the driveway. And I ignored it and thought, I'm going to go enjoy the walk and then come back. And it turned out to be a box of thousands of pages of his records from Bethesda Naval Hospital. It was an account of an alcoholic growing more desperate. And the starting the day that he was censured by the Senate at the end of 1954 to the day he died 3 years later, you could trace, and the doctors did trace, his increasing consumption of alcohol, the DTs, the delirium tremens, and other symptoms that he would show. And while his official death record said that he died of acute hepatitis, and that's what every journalist in America reported, the doctor's actual notes make clear that he died from the effects of his alcoholism.
We're talking with Larry Tye. The new book is called Demagogue, and you can join in. How have you heard the term McCarthyism used today? What do you remember about Senator Joe McCarthy from history class? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Chris now, joining us from Adams. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. I took a class on the House Un-American Activities Committee with respect to the blacklisting of people in Hollywood, but I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about another cog in the triumvirate. People need to understand that Robert La Follette Sr. was the chair of the Labor Committee in the Senate and was responsible for all of the social labor law that we have, unemployment compensation and the National Labor Relations Board, all that kind of stuff. And Walter Kohler was so angry that they passed laws, because there was a strike going on at the Kohler Company during this whole period of time, longest strike in the history of the country. And Walter Kohler, the Kohler family was determined to unseat the La Follette family from all politics in the state of Wisconsin. And so Walter Kohler Sr. ran for governor, and Walter Kohler Jr. ran for governor, and they basically did unseat the La Follettes from any further participation. Bob La Follette Jr. actually committed suicide after this whole thing.
Well, Chris, I want to jump in here and ask Larry, was there a connection there with the Kohler family supporting McCarthy?
So, in fact, the Walter Kohler Jr. was thinking about running for senator at the same time McCarthy did. And McCarthy did a classic McCarthy move to scare him out of the race. He basically went to Kohler and said, "You've recently been divorced. How would you like to see that failed marriage splayed across the pages of Wisconsin newspapers?" And Kohler said, "Geez, who would do that? Who would do a thing like that?" And McCarthy answered very simply, "I would." And at that time, the idea of a divorce was still enough of a stigmatized event in somebody's life that the idea of doing what McCarthy was threatening to do was enough to convince Kohler Jr. not to run against him then. And it was classic McCarthy. If he could charm you, he would charm you. If it took a bulldozer, he would take the bulldozer. And he did that repeatedly from his earliest days to his last days.
McCarthy became chair of the Committee on Government Operations and the Subcommittee on Investigations. How did his attacks intensify from that point?
So once he got actual power, before he became chair of that committee in early 1953, he had been exercising all of his crusade against communism from behind the scenes. Once he had actual power and was given that gavel, from day one, he went after not just what he said were communists, but he went after his political enemies, trying to destroy them. And he used his power in the way that we were talking about before, by holding these hearings behind closed doors, by attacking his enemies, by trampling on rights, by doing all the things that we think of in the words that I probably overuse in the book when we think of what a bully or a demagogue does.
How did he decide whom to target?
So some people say that he, in the middle of the night, in the dark, would grab any piece of paper that he could and just pick it at random and wave it in the air when he was giving a speech the next day. And if reporters asked to see the paper showing that he had, for instance, his famous list of 205 communists at the State Department, he would say, "I left the list in my briefcase," or "I left it on the plane." Some people suggest that his early numbers, when he first announced his attack against the State Department in a famous speech in 1950 in Wheeling, West Virginia, In the days after that speech, as he made page one of every newspaper, his numbers varied. Sometimes it was 205 communists at the State Department. Sometimes it was 57. And one friend said the 57 number came from McCarthy's having loved hamburgers and loved Heinz 57 sauce and just decided that that was a good number, as good a number as any. They seemed almost that random.
Biographer Larry Tye's new book is called Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. We're looking at his four-year quest to root out communism in the State Department, the destructiveness of his rhetoric. What do you remember from his words, his speeches? Do you have family arguments about the politics of the Republican from Wisconsin? Where was the division? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update with Larry Tye. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're discussing the new biography of Senator Joe McCarthy of Wisconsin. It's called Demagogue. Here is McCarthy, more archival footage here, 1954, drilling the Democratic Senator Stuart Symington of Missouri, who led the Senate committee that resulted in McCarthy's censure.
I would like to ask him now, even though he's not under oath, whether he has any information at all of any kind to justify this attempted smear against these 14 young men who have done such an excellent job uncovering communists.
Ty gives us viewership numbers of this moment. He writes, 30 million people switched on their TV sets the first day of the clash between the senator and the army, with 50 million more listening on the radio or following in newspapers and magazines. How do you remember the congressional hearings that brought the fall of McCarthy? 800-642-1234. Let's take another call now. Mike is with us from Madison. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you this morning?
Good, thank you.
I would like the guests to comment on Joe McCarthy's participation in defending the Nazis who murdered about 130 American soldiers in the Battle of the Bulge, and on his anti-Semitism at Malmedy, I'm talking about. The author probably knows what I'm talking about.
Mike, thank you for that. And what about the war crimes in World War II? McCarthy sided with some Nazi soldiers convicted of murdering U.S. troops.
Before he had launched his anti-communist crusade, and as the caller rightfully said, it was arguably the most horrific massacre of Americans during World War II. It was a bunch of American soldiers who were holding up a white flag and who were gunned down or killed with rifle butts to the head by Nazi SS troops. The Nazis, after the war, were tracked down, were tried. Most of them were sentenced to death, and they were defended, strangely, as some investigations went on, by a collection of ex-Nazis, by some journalists, by a number of peace activists, and by one junior senator from Wisconsin named Joe McCarthy. And why he defended those murderers at the Malmedy massacre is unclear to me. There's a theory that it was to make a pitch for German-American votes of his constituents in Wisconsin. And I think that does a great disservice to those German-American constituents. There's a theory that it was him just looking, as the opportunist that he was, for an issue that would give him headlines. And it gave him headlines, but I'm not sure the kind, they were the kind that he wanted, and certainly not the kind you would expect from a war hero senator. I think that they also reflected a tinge of, and maybe more than a tinge of, anti-Semitism. It came up repeatedly during his career when he would use words like sheeny, which is a slur word, an anti-Semitic slur. When he would call people good-for-nothing Jews, young staffers of his, when he would confide to friends that they were good-for-nothing Jews. And I think it was more than language. It was, in the case of Malmedy, a total insensitivity to just how horrific the Nazis' crimes against American troops and against Jews were. And it was a sad undercurrent of McCarthy's life and career that resurfaced repeatedly.
people who were gay, openly gay, in government, any position, they too were a target of Joe McCarthy. Why did he target people who were gay?
So I think it's one more set of slurs that when we look back, we rightfully think of as horrific. It was the so-called Lavender Scare, and it went along with the Red Scare. And it meant that if you were gay and he had any hint of that, he assumed automatically that you were a security risk, that you could be blackmailed by the Soviets, that you could turn as a spy. And if anybody, given some of the things we've already talked about, if anybody was subject to blackmail, it was a senator who liked to drink, who liked to gamble, who liked to, what we would call in an un-PC term, but they called at the time, to womenize. It was things that he was doing in his private life that made him substantially more vulnerable by the theory he was using to go after gays. And I think it was just one more case of looking for a convenient scapegoat. And in that era especially, gays made an easy one.
You mentioned Roy Cohn earlier, who was McCarthy's aide and legal counsel to a subcommittee, and you've been drawing some parallels in your book about President Trump. And Roy Cohn there, a direct connection, was Donald Trump's lawyer in earlier years. Where do you see some of those comparisons between Joe McCarthy and the actions of President Trump?
So I think that demagogues like McCarthy and all the ones who have come after, when they're attacked, they aim a wrecking ball at their assailants. When one charge against a manufactured enemy is exposed as hollow, they lob a fresh bombshell. If the news is bad, they blame the newsmen and the newswomen. All of those are tactics that McCarthy used. All of those are tactics I think that seem familiar in terms of things that Donald Trump does in the headlines every day. And the idea that there was this flesh and blood through line, the idea that Joe McCarthy's protege turned out nearly half a century later to be Donald Trump's tutor, to me is more than an accident.
What were his colleagues in the Senate doing? Why were they not standing up to him?
So if I could ever be that short-winded, I would answer in two words, not enough. They were not standing up to him. In the case of the Democrats, it was what Minority Leader Lyndon Johnson said, which was McCarthy was a Republican, and it was up to the Republicans to take him down. And the Democrats had already seen that every time a Democratic senator stood up to McCarthy, McCarthy would go after them with a vengeance that often meant they're losing their battles for re-election. And Johnson advised his members wisely and uncourageously to leave him alone. The Republicans, meanwhile, had a very narrow majority when they took back the Senate in 1953, and they didn't want to threaten it by taking on one of their own members, and they didn't want to tempt McCarthy to go after them. The guy in America back then who could most easily have taken on Joe McCarthy, the one person more popular than McCarthy in all the national polls, was our war hero President Dwight Eisenhower. And many people say Eisenhower wisely waited until McCarthy slipped up and until he took on an enemy too big to bully, like the army. I think Eisenhower may have been a war hero president, but in the case of Joe McCarthy, he showed a huge lack of courage and lack of leadership. Eisenhower's brother Milton was whispering in his ear for 2 years, give up some of that popularity and take down the bully. And Eisenhower didn't do it until lots of lives had been ruined.
We're talking with Larry Tye, author of the new book, Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. And you can join in with your questions, your reflections on the senator at 800-642-1234. You had so many interviews and you were trying to chase down people, as you said, you know, before they were old and died. You also had conversations with the family. What were those like?
Those were a little bit eerie because, understandably, people who were McCarthy's relatives, whether they had really known him much and whether they were children at the time, still hated the idea that their uncle, their whatever, was disparaged in the way that McCarthy had been by history. And particularly if they carry the McCarthy name with them, it was one that, if people made that connection, was one that wasn't easy to carry. And so on the one hand, they wanted to defend him and wanted to make sure before they would talk to me that I was going to be fair. And on the other hand, without the family cooperation, the book could never have been done, or at least been done with any sense of new insights on him. And if I could, I would like to just say one last thing. One of the ways that McCarthy was enabled, and one of his most consistent battles over the years, and something that again is being mirrored today, is McCarthy's battle with the media. And in the beginning, it was the press who put him on the front page and who made him into a national phenomenon. But over the years, intrepid reporters, especially in Wisconsin, took him on at great peril to themselves. And I feel like being here today talking on public radio, I can't help but make a pitch for all of your listeners to call in and make donations to stations like yours, because it is a free press like yours that's going to ensure that we don't have demagogues who can survive in this era. The only real check, the public doesn't have the time and the resources to go out there and keep politicians honest. It is journalists and it shows like this that do that.
How did he take on journalists? Who did he target and what happened to their lives?
So the one that he targeted most fiercely and the one who took him on earliest and most consistently was the most famous newspaper columnist in America at the time, who also had a big radio show, and his name was Drew Pearson. And Pearson initially started out as McCarthy's buddy. The way he watched him operate up close, he ended up becoming his fiercest critic. And McCarthy took him on in two ways. One is when they met one night at a Washington supper club, he actually physically assaulted Pearson. And it was only a Quaker senator, soon to be president, named Richard Nixon, who came in and separated the two and probably saved Pearson from a real pummeling. But more importantly, McCarthy went after Pearson on the floor of the Senate, where he would be protected from any slander that he was issuing, and encouraged America to no longer support sponsors who would support Drew Pearson's radio show. And what that ended up meaning was Pearson lost his biggest sponsor, a company called Adam Hats. And what that meant was it wasn't just Pearson McCarthy was going after. He was sending a message to journalists, you take me on at your own peril.
Biographer Larry Tye's new book is called Demagogue. It's about the rise and fall of Senator Joe McCarthy of Wisconsin. Still time to talk about your remembrances of McCarthy, his politics, that era. We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute with author Larry Tye right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Biographer Larry Tye is spending the hour with us, and he chronicles Senator Joe McCarthy's anti-communist campaign, draws parallels, as we've been hearing, to the Trump administration, saying that President Trump, quote, owes much to McCarthy's playbook. Do you draw comparisons between now and then? What do you see in McCarthy's rhetoric? What confuses you about his life in the era of the Red Scare? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Larry Tye's new book is called Demagogue, and he stays with us. Let's take another call now. Al is with us from Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Al.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
How are you?
Good, go ahead.
Yeah, I was interested. You know, I did not live during the McCarthy era, but I thought it was interesting how the parallels of today are, you know, back then. You know, McCarthy, how he was pretty ruthless at the meetings behind closed doors, and it kind of reminds us of the times that are going on today.
Al, thank you for that. And Larry, you read thousands of pages of transcripts of the closed hearings. What was he like behind closed doors?
So normally you would expect when the doors closed that a senator would be more restrained, and that when the cameras came out that they'd be showing their more aggressive tendencies and playing to the cameras. With McCarthy, it was, I think, just the opposite, that he was relatively restrained when the cameras were out, and behind closed doors, there was no need to hold back at all. So we saw Joe McCarthy unhinged. But I also think that he used the closed door sessions in a quite brilliant and insidious way. What he did was tested out witnesses. If they looked like they were terrific in responding compellingly to the charges he was leveling at them, they never made it into a public session. The witnesses he preferred were ones that would crumble or ones that would cave. And I think that he wanted to stage the two-thirds of his hearings that he was holding behind closed doors as a warm-up act for what he did when he let in the press and public.
How did the American public take this in on TV, and do we know what Americans were thinking?
So we know by the Gallup polls that were held then, and at the beginning of his hearings in 1954, the Army-McCarthy hearings, the famous hearings after he had taken on the Army and said that a fort in New Jersey was infested with spies, at the beginning of those hearings, Joe McCarthy was the second most popular man in America, behind Dwight Eisenhower. A full 50% of Americans, one in every two Americans, thought he was doing a great job. But when they watched him day after day in the most highly publicized hearings we had ever held of any congressional activities, and they watched him go from being this heroic anti-communist to looking more like a town bully, his numbers dropped so precipitously that by the end of the hearings in August, he was down to one in three Americans, 34%, from 50% to 34% in the matter of months. And it was all because people could watch what he looked like and what he was saying.
What was he accusing the Army of in the Army-McCarthy hearings?
He said that the most famous spy in American history, Julius Rosenberg, the famous atomic spy, he said that there were still nests of spies, some planted by Rosenberg, at this fort called Monmouth in New Jersey, which was one of the command and control centers for all the armed services. He said that they were passing secrets to the Soviets, and he said, "We better darn well watch out." And at the beginning, the Army caved to him. They started suspending people he was naming, all of whom got their jobs back, or all but one of whom. By the end, the Army decided that if you gave in to McCarthy on an inch, he'd take a mile. They stood up, they had backbone, so did Eisenhower, and they fought back. And by the end of the Army-McCarthy hearings, neither the Army nor McCarthy looked very good.
Can you tell, at any rate, did McCarthy believe? Did he believe his own rhetoric and the smears?
So that's a great question, and the answer is yes and no. At the beginning, I think that he was just looking for an issue that would catapult him to re-election and to a spotlight. When he delivered his first and most famous speech on the anti-communist crusade in Wheeling, West Virginia in February of 1950, he actually went there with two speeches in his briefcase. One was a snoozer on national housing policy that he actually knew something about. But if he had given that speech that night, you and I, 70 years later, wouldn't be on the air talking about him. Instead, he grabbed from his briefcase a speech that he knew very little about in terms of foreign policy and anti-communism. He delivered that speech, he got the headlines that he wanted, and he never turned back. And I'm convinced that bringing two speeches was a sign of the opportunism. He would have grabbed any issue that gave him the spotlight. But by the end, I'm also convinced that he was a true believer. He had repeated in such mind-numbing fashion the charges so many times over the years that whether or not the country believed him, I think Joe McCarthy did by the end.
Larry Tighe, author of the new book, Demagogue, we're exploring the life of Senator Joseph McCarthy. Larry, what was McCarthy's reputation like when he died in 1957?
it was the thing that he most dreaded, which is that people had almost forgotten who he was. His colleagues shunned him. The public didn't pay attention. Reporters stopped putting him not just on the front page, but anywhere in the newspaper. And I'm convinced if he had run for a third term in Wisconsin, that he would have been defeated. So by the end, it took only the true believers who were still with him. And like most demagogues, given the rope, he had sadly hung himself.
As you look at all of these original documents, these first-person documents, how important are they to sizing up who Joe McCarthy was?
So I think we could stick with the great biographies that had been done before and the caricature of the character in history books, but I think these documents opened up a level of nuance for better and more often for worse on just who Joe McCarthy was. How can you write about somebody convincingly and definitively if you don't have their stash of personal and professional papers, if you don't have their closed-door hearings, if you don't have the full set of records from the Marines and his medical records?
Your organization must be incredible. I mean, to keep track of so many documents and how they fit together in this puzzle of the man.
So I am like you. I'm a journalist first, and I think that what we do every day as journalists is we organize material. And the challenge of writing a book versus writing a newspaper story is that there's just a whole lot more of it. On the other hand, the opportunity of writing a book rather than a newspaper story is that you have endless time to do it. And to me, I had a blast taking all of that material and spending day after day wading through it at a time when I would also be reading the daily newspaper and think, geez, a lot of what I'm reading about from 70 years ago sure looks like today's headlines.
And I want to ask you there, are you concerned by what you have written about this demagogue, that the U.S. couldn't go through that again, and yet you draw so many parallels to what you see today? Does that give you pause?
So I'm an optimist, and rather than giving me pause, it gives me a sense of hope for the future. I think that while America too often, like much of the world, buys into bullies and demagogues, whether their name is Huey Long or Joe McCarthy or George Wallace, in the end, with every one of them, we end up seeing through them. And I have great faith in American judgment, if not the speed of its judgment.
So as we start to wrap up here, what do you do next? Because this was a huge project and you sunk so much years of your life into it. Where do you go next?
So I'm deep into my next book, and it is my reward to myself and my publisher's reward for me for spending nearly 3 years with Joe McCarthy. It is a book called The Jazzmen, J-A-Z-Z-M-E-N, How Duke Ellington, Satchmo Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America.
Oh, well, we'll be waiting for it. Larry, thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Larry Tighe, author of the new book, Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy, which was released just this week. Just ahead, it is On Point. After most of the country started to reopen in earnest, coronavirus infection numbers have risen again in many states. On Point takes stock. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.